forget frequently asked questions.
Common sense, common knowledge, or Google.
How about advice from a real genius? 95% of people in any profession are good enough to be qualified and licensed. 5%
go above and beyond.
They become very good at what they do, but only
0.1%.
are real geniuses. Richard Jacobs has made it his life's mission to find them for you. He hunts down and interviews geniuses in every field. Sleep science, cancer, stem cells, ketogenic diets, and more. Here come the geniuses. This is the Finding Genius Podcast
with Richard Jacobs.
Hello, this is Richard Jacobs with the Finding Genius Podcast, now part of the Finding Genius Foundation. My guest today is Will Hall. He's the author of a book called Outside Mental Health, Voices and Visions of Madness. It talks about the human side of mental illness. It's a collection of interviews and essays. So Will is also a therapist, a host of Madness Radio. He's a schizophrenia survivor. And the question he appears to ask in the book is, what does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? So it should be a very interesting talk. So Will, thank you so much for coming.
Hey, Richard, thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
If you would, tell me a bit about your background. When did you start to have symptoms of schizophrenia? What was it like when all this first started happening?
Well, if I look back into my childhood, I see I had experiences that were very troubling and confusing and overwhelming that later got fit into the narrative of schizophrenia. But I want to take a step back and that I'm among the movement and the tendency or the trend of really challenging the idea of schizophrenia or the idea of psychosis in the way that we understand it. I have a very different perspective. So that's why my book is called Outside Mental Health and why we ask, what does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? So when I was a kid, I would sometimes hear voices. I would become very withdrawn and gripped by a paralyzing fear, and I wouldn't be able to talk. I remember sometimes there was so much confusion in my mind that I would just be separate and withdrawn from other people. I had really strange kind of sensory experiences. I remember one day looking up at the ceiling and watching cartoons playing on the ceiling. There was a time in the playground, I guess, again, third grade, when some kind of force or invisible presence like grabbed me and threw me down. And at the time, no one was really paying much attention or really connecting with me. I grew up in a family. I love my parents. I don't blame my parents, but there was a lot of trauma, a lot of difficulties, a lot of problems that my parents had. And so growing up, I never really had much language for emotions or for what I was going through. But eventually I did end up in the mental health system. I ended up being put in the University of California, San Francisco, Langley Porter Psychiatric Institute. I was there for a couple of months, and the whole experience didn't help me. It didn't do anything for me. Being part of the system, taking the medications, doing the treatments, being in hospitals really only seemed to make things worse. And so when I got out, it took me a long time, but eventually it was by connecting with the patients movement, the survivor movement, the MAD movement, that helped me to kind of rethink and develop some new understandings. And now my view is that, okay, some people are helped by the system. I'm not anti-medication. I understand that some people are helped by medication, but a lot of people are harmed. And a lot of people are like me, they're looking for alternatives. And so that became my life's work. I got involved with starting support groups. I was involved in advocacy and activism. And then eventually I decided to get a degree in counseling. And now I do counseling as my main work, and I also do training, and I've actually been invited into a PhD program, so I'm doing some PhD work related to mental health as well.
Well, I want to ask you about your experiences. From what I've heard in interviews, 50 to 75% of people that have schizophrenia are adamant that they're fine. You know, whatever they see and experience, they know others will tell them, no, that's not true, or, you know, that's not there, but they'll say, nope. It's there, and they won't agree. Did you have any of that, or did you know that there was something going on?
Well, I would question that statistic, because there does tend to be, there's a view that says that schizophrenia, or what we call schizophrenia or bipolar or psychosis, is kind of like Alzheimer's. The person is damaged and they're just not capable of seeing what's going on. It's like dementia. And that really is not based in research. That's not based in experience. That the reality is that people definitely can be reached and they can be connected with. Psychotherapy was a very successful and very widely used treatment for manic depressive disorder and schizophrenia and psychosis before the big push of pharma and medications. Now it's medications, medications, medications. So there's truth in what you're saying is that people do disconnect. I was very disconnected from the people around me. I was having experiences that other people were not having, hearing voices or believing that people were trying to hurt me. So it was a very isolating, a solitary kind of world I was in. But I would question whether the best way to respond to that is to say, I'm right and you're wrong. You're diseased. You've got a problem. You just got to forget about all this stuff and pay attention to us, obey what we're saying, take your medications, and then just identify as someone who is ill. But actually, that's a way to alienate people and disconnect. A lot of times, the people who are saying, I'm not ill, I'm not ill, I'm not ill, are in a power struggle because they're not being listened to. They don't want to take medications. They don't want to be in the system. They don't want to be locked up. And so a lot of the work that I do is based on my experience of connecting. Like, I want to relate to people. I want to okay, you're angry, you're upset, you're frustrated, you don't want to take these medications, you're in conflict with your family. I want to listen to you. I want to be on your side. And then once you start to build a connection, someone might reach the point where they say, well, okay, I'll try some medication, or hey, let me have a conversation with a doctor. Let me think about what my goals are. But typically there's a giant power struggle going on. I don't want to make the power struggle worse by telling someone that they're crazy. That's one of the worst things that you can do. If anybody, I think a lot of listeners are going to relate to this, but if you have an argument with your partner, at some point, your partner will say, this happened, this happened. You'll say, no, it didn't, no, it didn't. You're crazy. That never happened. I never said that. So the idea of telling someone that their reality isn't real or that they're crazy just destroys empathy. It destroys connection. It's really a conflict. So I would agree that absolutely conflict and different points of view is at the heart of what we call madness or schizophrenia or bipolar or psychosis. But I don't think that the answer is just to push the power struggle even harder, if that makes sense.
But what do you do if, let's say again, you have a child that has schizophrenia and, let's say they're 18 or something like that, and they tell you they're seeing stuff or they're hearing stuff or they think so-and-so's after them, or what do you say? How do you acknowledge that when that's not your experience and they're saying these things that are really worrisome?
That's a great question. It is a problem. So if I say schizophrenia doesn't exist, I don't see the world from the perspective of schizophrenia existing. It's not to say that there isn't a problem. And there is a lot of research. I've worked with Sandra Escher, who's the co-founder of the Hearing Voices movement. And I would encourage your listeners to check out the Hearing Voices movement and the work of Sandra Escher. She's a psychiatric researcher who's very involved in support groups, and she works and specializes. She's passed now. She's a wonderful, wonderful Dutch leader in the movement. Her specialty was children who hear voices, children who have psychosis. And one of the worst things that you can do if a child comes to you is respond with fear. If you say, oh no, you have schizophrenia, we have to get you to the doctor, and then the doctor is afraid and everyone's, no, that actually can make the situation worse. That it's actually quite common for children to hear voices, for children to have imaginary friends, for children to have strange experiences, and again, empathy and connection. So children is a special question, and there is specific research about that. But your broader question is like, well, what do you do if someone is in a weird, altered state, or maybe they're not eating, or they're doing something dangerous or self-destructive, or they're not going to work? And fortunately, there's a whole movement. It's called the peer recovery movement that is out there addressing this very question, the Hearing Voices movement, peer specialists, people who've been in the system, people who've been in hospitals, who've been receiving treatments, who've figured out ways to move on and deal and cope. And so often talking to people who've been through that experience can help the person start to bridge the gap into ordinary reality. And again, the way to do it is not through a power struggle, but it's through listening and empathy and compassion, because it's a strange thing. If someone has Alzheimer's or dementia, they're going to have a really hard time doing anything. They can have a hard time showing up for appointments. They have a hard time cooking eggs. They will not be able to drive a car. It's very strange because people who have a schizophrenia or bipolar diagnosis, the vast majority will be able to do things like show up with appointments or drive a car or communicate, but then they have this corner of their life which seems very strange or very. So my interest is in connecting with the person in the ways that they're in ordinary reality, and then helping bridge to that part of their life that is outside of ordinary reality.
Before we continue, I've been personally funding the Finding Genius podcast for 4.5 years now, which has led to 2,700 plus interviews of clinicians, researchers, scientists, CEOs, and other amazing people who are working to advance science and improve our lives and our world. Even though this podcast gets 100,000 plus downloads a month, we need your help to reach hundreds of thousands more worldwide. Please visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click on Support Us. We have 3 levels of membership from $10 to $49 a month, including perks such as the ability to see ahead in our interview calendar and ask questions of upcoming guests, transcripts of podcasts you're interested in, the ability to request specific topics or guests, and more. Visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click Support Us today. Now, back to the show.
And often I will ask them, okay, well, how is this creating difficulties in your life? Yeah. Hearing voices is a great example. The vast majority of people who hear voices don't have a problem. We have a stereotype that says hearing voices is part of schizophrenia. Well, Paul McCartney of the Beatles, he heard voices. Socrates heard voices. Carl Jung, many heard voices. Many poets, many artists, many musicians, many religious and spiritual people will hear voices. So I'll try and find out, well, is it creating a problem for the person? So if a child comes to you and says, mommy, there was a voice in my bedroom last night, and I'm hearing this experience, responding in a way that brings the fear down, and then helping to normalize it. Okay, you're having this experience. What else is going on in your life? Is it making it hard to do your homework? Is it making it hard to relate to other kids at school? And then going from there, from a problem-solving standpoint that's related to listening, results from listening. And I know this is a very different point of view, but I think listeners really need to realize that what we hear in the media and from psychiatry and what I heard in the hospitals is not the only way of understanding these experiences. The hearing voices movement and the MAD movement, there's the Critical Psychiatry Network, there's the website MAD in America, there's my podcast, Madness Radio. There's a whole realm of researchers, scientists, doctors, nurses, because I work with psychiatrists who share these perspectives. I work with doctors, I work with nurses who are part of the hearing voices movement. So people have to understand that there's a real diversity, a real difference of opinions about how to respond and how to understand these experiences. The mind is a very mysterious, mysterious thing. We haven't got answers. So there's a lot of different ways of approaching the questions that you're raising, for sure.
Yeah, but so what, multiple sessions, and if someone is spoken to in the right way, what happens? They get an inkling that what they're experiencing is not real, or like what happens over time?
Sometimes. Okay, so we're talking about millions of people. So we're talking about a huge diversity of people. I wouldn't want to say everybody who's homeless or everybody who has substance abuse, addiction problems with alcohol or cocaine or something is the same. So everybody is going to be different. I can talk about what my experience is, but what I've seen and what the research supports is that, yeah, people start to explore what works for them. So, for example, for some people, if they are going through intense paranoia and they're going through intense being withdrawn from the world, they isolate in their room, then finding other people to talk to who they can trust and they can connect with can happen slowly over time. And then they might find that those beliefs that they're getting poisoned, or that there's a microchip implanted in them, or there's men in black or surveilling them from outside, those feelings and those beliefs might go down. They might be less powerful. Maybe the feelings are, the beliefs are still there, but they learn how to cope. Well, yeah, I had a really intense paranoia today. I thought that, you know, my neighbor was spying on me again, but today I remembered to take my walk, and I did some of my deep breathing exercises. And I remembered to call my sponsor in AA, and that helped bring my fear down. So people learn coping mechanisms. And yes, some people, their what we call madness or their symptoms do disappear and go away. But sometimes people learn to live with those experiences. I still hear voices. I still go through paranoia, times of extreme mistrust, where I have incredible strange beliefs about the people around me and they're trying to hurt me. And I've learned coping mechanisms. We all learn coping tools and wellness practices. Everybody knows I need my coffee, or I need to go for my walk, or I need to spend time with my dog, or I talk with my partner, or I go to church. And these are the things that create wellness. So a lot of times the people who have these different diagnoses, they need just the same thing that everybody else needs. But we've unfortunately put them in a box where all we're thinking about is medication. So to answer your question, like, yes, sometimes people work in therapy and it brings the problems more under control. Sometimes also I don't want to, you know, claim that this is an answer for everything. I mean, everybody's different. And some people we don't know how to reach. And we do the best and we try different things. We try and be flexible. I mean, ultimately, this is a mystery and everybody is unique. But there's a huge realm of research out there that support groups, that psychotherapy, sometimes nutrition changes. I've talked with people who were able to get their voices or their delusions under control because they realized that they were allergic to gluten. And I'm not saying everybody who's allergic to gluten is, you know, going to be diagnosed schizophrenic, or everybody who's diagnosed schizophrenic is going to be cured if you put some people find, for example, that it's about sleep. So for me, if I don't get to sleep, if I don't have my regular sleep, yeah, I'm going to start heading down the road of hearing more aggressive voices, more persecutory voices.
Oh, really?
Isolated. Yeah. Sleep is probably the single biggest factor. And one thing that we should
is there remember, you mentioned sleep. Do people that have schizophrenia certainly bipolar in their manic phase, sleeping doesn't work very well. But what about for schizophrenia? Do people that have schizophrenia have sleep disorders or disrupted sleep?
Well, let's take a step back. So if we talk about voices or mania or going psychotic, anyone listening to this podcast can go psychotic. Anyone. It's part of what it is to be human. So if anybody doesn't sleep enough, if you are sleep deprived, 3, 4, 5, 6, if you're under certain kinds of extreme stress, if you are isolated, you will start to lose your grip on reality. Everyone has this inherent quality of the human mind. People are going to go, they're going to become psychotic at different times. Some people are more vulnerable. But yes, absolutely. Managing sleep can not only help prevent a manic state, but also it can help reduce anxiety and help people with going into those what we call delusional or psychotic states. Absolutely. And the boundaries between bipolar and schizophrenic and mania and psychosis are blurry. They're very kind of distinct, like walls in the psychiatric view. But actually, when you talk to people and get to know people, the people have different kinds of experiences. People have different relationships to these things. So when I talk to people, I say, well, okay, you don't want to go back in the hospital again. Well, what happened that you went to the hospital? Oh, well, I had an episode and this was, well, what was, I wasn't sleeping. I wasn't eating. The voices got really strong. Ah, okay. Well, let's see. What can we do to help you to learn to eat more regularly? How can we help you to learn to get to sleep? What happens if you start down that snowball of sleep deprivation? How can you interrupt it? And this is where I want to emphasize, I'm not anti-medications. I mean, my goodness, if someone isn't sleeping and they need to sleep, sometimes hitting them with a dose of antipsychotics or a benzodiazepine or something will help them sleep. And then boom, it'll knock their altered state right out. They'll come out of it. But the question is, does the person then need to keep taking the meds every day for the rest of their life? This is the false message. It's very individual. It may not be. Maybe it's just a sleep management issue. So we have put these issues in different boxes. So when someone has this schizophrenia diagnosis, we don't talk with them about nutrition. We don't talk with them about sleep. We don't talk with them about expressing their feelings or psychotherapy or exercise. We just say, oh, meds, meds, meds. Are you compliant? And again, I'm not anti-medication, but a lot of people are harmed by medication. And for a lot of people, medications aren't helpful. So we have to have a more open-minded view in my perspective.
Yeah, that's where people go, right? Medication. So what is it? Is it a mental stalemate or a perception stalemate, let's say, that families would have with a loved one that's starting to show these symptoms? You know, the person's telling them, I'm seeing you're experiencing XYZ, and they're saying, no, that's crazy, or that's not right, or just something wrong with you. And from there, it's just like, I guess both sides are just trying to protect themselves, and that's why this persists. Like, you know, what do you think is the dynamic that evolves when this first starts happening?
I think you described it really well. I think that for a lot of people, there is that power struggle that happens. And unfortunately, you know, a lot of families are based on power struggle. People aren't listening to each other. If a young person comes to mom or dad and says, hey, I want to tell you something, and their response from mom or dad is, no, that's not happening. Be quiet about that. That's not real. That's not a really good relationship. That's there's something is really disconnected there in the caring. So I would hope people would be more open and curious. And then, yeah, I mean, a lot of the conflicts that happen just naturally as part of being an adolescent and growing up, I mean, there's teenage rebellion, there's finding independence. There's, you know, mom and dad don't like weed, so I'm going to smoke as much weed as I can get my hands on. And then you go psychotic because cannabis can drive you into a psychotic state. And then mom and dad say, look, you're smoking weed. You got to stop the weed. That's what's making you drop out of school. And that's why you can't take care of yourself. And that's why you can't. And then the young person just says, F you. I love my weed. I'm going to smoke even more weed, because it's a family conflict. It's a disconnect between the authority figures and the rebellious teenagers. So a lot of the work that I do, and I encourage your listeners to look this up as well, open dialogue is an approach that I trained in, where we do family meetings. Basically, we do family meetings. And the work isn't so much how do we get this, you know, hallucination under control or this psychosis under control. It's like, how do we improve the communication? How do we get people working as a team here? How do we get the family back on track for listening to each other? And that means listening to everybody, listening to someone, even if they say, you know, I hate my father. He comes into my room every night. He puts a microchip in my brain. It's like, okay, I'm going to listen to this person, because telling them, oh no, that's not true, that's not real, is probably going to shut them down and make them feel even more alienated. I'm going to try and build a bridge. I'm going to be like, okay, that's your perspective. What's the perspective of, it sounds like it's really scary. I'll try and build a bridge with emotion. Wow, that's really, God, you must be terrified to not be able to be safe in your room and someone's coming in every night. And then gradually, often, sometimes, people will start to open up and they'll start to connect and they'll start to trust. And that's when the work, I think, really starts to begin. So you're absolutely right. It is a power struggle. It is that conflict of my reality is right, yours isn't. But again, these are hugely complex questions. We're talking about an incredible diversity of human experience. And also, we're talking about the human mind, which is the single most complicated object we've ever encountered in the universe. We do not know how the mind comes out of the body. We know that there's a connection, but there's something called the hard problem in consciousness studies, where they do not know what consciousness is or how it arises. So we have to have a certain amount of humility. My real teacher in all this is William James, the psychologist from 100 and something years ago, William James. And he was a pragmatist. He says, look, you know, let's focus on what works. How useful is this theory? How is it useful for you? If you're a certain belief is useful, and if you believe in a God in heaven who's going to come down for judgment day and is keeping track of everyone's sins, if that's useful for you, if that helps you live a better life, and then power to you. That's great. I totally support that. If believing that there's a God in heaven is going to come down and judge everyone makes you terrified and live in your room and obsess with everything that you do, then maybe it's not necessarily a helpful belief. So I have a very pragmatic approach, and a very humble approach to meeting everybody as an individual and kind of discovering what their reality is about.
So how often does this approach work versus traditional approaches? And what is it? How much does it take? Quite a bit of time, or what, you know, what do you notice about it?
Yeah. I mean, look, sometimes it's as simple as one meeting. Mom has a meeting with me and she says, I'm terrified. My daughter is hearing voices. I meet with the daughter, and the daughter is, she's in school. She's successful in school. Yeah, she takes mushrooms, magic mushrooms. She smokes weed with her friends. She gets weird, but she's basically okay. I go back to the mom and I say, Mom, just be okay. Just relax. Go to the gym. Start dating again. Live your life. Your daughter's going to be fine. Don't worry about your daughter. She's hearing voices, but just listen with empathy and compassion and don't make a big deal about it. You don't need to try meds. You don't try. And then that's all it takes. It reduces the fear. The family moves on. Other times, there's very difficult situations that go on, and we start to run up against the society isn't providing support. The daughter needs to live away from the parents because there's so much conflict, but there's no resources. There's no housing programs. So sometimes the problems can be exacerbated and driven by the social context. But to answer your question, I mean, the recovery rates, if we look at the recovery rate for schizophrenia and psychosis and bipolar, they're no better now than they were 100 years ago. In fact, we have a dramatically escalating problem with more and more medications, more and more people on disability. So the treatments that we're relying on for the majority of people are not working, and we need to have other treatments available to people. And there are a lot of studies that show that psychotherapy, or what's called psychosocial rehabilitation, helping people to live in the community, helping them to get jobs, support groups, that these things are effective for people, but they aren't being tried. They aren't being supported. We live in a regime where big pharma calls the shots. We're completely bombarded with pills are the answer. 24/7, our media is controlled by pharmaceutical advertising. You can't criticize big pharma on the news, you'll lose your advertisers. So the reality is that there are a lot of people who are harmed by mainstream treatments. There are a lot of people looking for alternatives, and we need to stop especially forcing mainstream treatments on people. We need to look at projects like the Soteria House project, which was developed in the 70s and 80s in California, that showed that if you give people a kind of a place that they can be, like a home-like environment that they can be, maybe they don't need medications. Maybe they just need people to talk to and hang out with and have a safe sanctuary. There's the peer respite movement. There are now hospital alternatives that are called peer respites that are available in many cities. I would love to see many more of these. There are Hearing Voices groups. There are groups that help people come off medications if that's their choice. There are groups that help people deal with suicidal feelings. So we need to have much more peer support, mutual aid. I mean, AA and the 12-step movement is a great example. I mean, imagine a world where you had, if you have alcohol problems or cocaine problems or heroin problems, all you can do is go and talk to your doctor. Well, no, going to support groups to talk to other addicts who have figured out, I don't know if I like that word addict, but other people with those same problems who figured out how to get out of that and how to overcome, is that that's a much more effective and useful option for people. So we need to have non-medical, non-pharma, non-psychiatric avenues that people can support, can access, and that can support them. And I really think that we're moving in that direction. There's a lot more peer support. The World Health Organization, the United Nations are pushing for more community-based and less medical-oriented and more voluntary treatments and services. There's more recognition of the importance of exercise, of nutrition, the role of trauma. We talk about schizophrenia and bipolar. We never talk about prevention, that child abuse and trauma and emotional neglect and poverty are hugely contributing to people developing.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. I can give you a quick example. Like, my kids go to a really large high school. There's about 5,000 students. And, you know, and seeing their friends, a lot of them come from broken homes. I mean, and it's really traumatizing the kids. They run away and they act out. And, you know, if I lowball it, I think it's lowballing. If I estimate 20% of the families at this one school, you know, or the home life's terrible, that's 1,000 families. And then when I look at that over the whole U.S., it's like at least 1 million families. It's probably, it could be 10 million families. It's crazy.
It's crazy.
So that whole generation of millions of people, yeah, that would be predisposed to these problems.
100%. And it's a problem that we could fix if we just prioritized it. There's no kid should grow up in poverty. We're the richest country in the world. We can solve these problems. But instead, a lot of the kids that you're talking about who run away and start acting out and have problems, they're going to be put on meds. They're going to be diagnosed as bipolar. They're going to be diagnosed as schizophrenic. They're going to be smoking weed. They have a psychotic experience smoking weed. Boom, now they're called schizophrenic. But actually, there's a whole chain of causation that's not being looked at. So 100% agree with you. If we're really interested in helping people with mental health problems, we have to look at the roots. We have to look at poverty. I don't know if I like the term broken homes, but I absolutely agree with you. That's what it is. There's problems that go back generationally. I mean, the kids are growing up. Both their parents have substance abuse issues. They have trauma that's never been addressed. There's been incest. There's been child abuse. There's been war trauma. People are veterans. There's poverty. So all these are all the different stressors that contribute to that point where you break. And then now you get grabbed by the psychiatric system. And then when I was in the hospital, they never asked me about trauma. They never asked me about my dad being in the Korean War, my mom being an orphan and being a sexual abuse survivor, and what was my family. They never asked me anything. It's just, are you hearing voices? Yes. Okay, let's put you on these medications. Is this medication working? No. Let's try a different medication. That was the entire framework that they brought. And it took me years of coming out of the hospitals, out of the systems, and start asking myself, wait a second, what did happen in my... I love my parents. I don't blame my parents. But hey, it was a pretty chaotic family that I grew up. Both my parents are pretty severe trauma survivors. And I understand now that because of that chaos and that neglect, really, just my emotional needs weren't being met. My parents' emotional needs weren't met from their parents. So not to blame them, but that's really the recipe that led to me. You know, I was on disability for 15 years. I got a disability check for 15 years. My life would have been very different if someone had come to our family when I was a teenager and said, hey, your family needs some support. Your parents have a lot of trauma. There's a lot of chaos. There's a lot of conflict. It's hard for you to communicate and talk about your feelings as a family. It's hard for you to come together as a family. There's lots of conflict between mom and dad. If someone had come in with resources and connection and offering support, not medications, but real emotional support and support groups and counseling, my life would have been very different, very different.
So what advice do you have for, again, people that a loved one is starting to, you know, show these concerning symptoms? What could they do versus what they probably would tend to do without this help?
Yeah, that's a great question, Richard. So I would say, first of all, take a breath and realize that it's very hard for families because you're getting one message and one message only, meds, meds, meds. So take a breath, check out a website like Mad in America. Check out the Hearing Voices movement. Learn about the alternatives that are out there. Go on to websites like the Inner Compass, Surviving Antidepressants. Find out what some of the experiences have been for people that go the medication route. A lot of those people really wish that they had not got on medications to begin with. And then don't be isolated. Try and connect with other parents, with other patients, with other survivors, and start to have conversations asking the question, what works for you? What worked for you? Now I can ask, what's going to work for me? Ask the question of like, what options do I have? Okay, we tried this, but we can try this. Let's think critically, get a second opinion. Don't just do what your doctor says. Realize that there's a fear message that comes out that makes you think, my God, I've got to just do what the doctor says or else. Well, actually, you can get a second opinion and a third opinion. You can do your own research. You can start reading. You can go to the Madness Radio website. There's a bunch of interviews about families on the Madness Radio interview. Just go to madnessradio.net and search for families. Listen to some of the stories of people. Go to a website called Families Healing Together, which is a great alternative approach for family support, and get educated. Start to think about what your options are. And it's really hard. I mean, there's not a lot of resources out there for families. Families are in crisis too. Caregivers are under incredible stress as well. So I work a lot with family members. I work a lot with parents and the pressures that are put on them to be the social worker and to be the care manager and to be the case manager and to be the counselor and to be the researcher and to be the logistics administrator. I mean, it's totally unfair. The system is very broken. But be very cautious about organizations like NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. They get funding from pharma. They push the take your meds. You know, they have a lot of support groups and there are a lot of good people in those support groups. There are a lot of good people, but a lot of times you go to the support groups and they're just, how do I get my kid to take meds? How do I get my kid to take meds? How do I get my kid to take meds? Seek out the people who are saying, well, wait a second, maybe that's not the only perspective. Watch out for you Google about schizophrenia or psychosis and bipolar. I guarantee all the top results, they're connected to pharma funding. Pharma is a huge multi-billion dollar industry. They have all kinds of sponsorship. They have front groups with charities. They're very influential. And they're doing their job. You can't, in one sense, you can't blame them. Their job is to make money. They're a private industry that's under the system that we're in. We have private profit healthcare. And as long as you're under that system, it's going to be about more drugs, more treatments. Think about it. If you make money off of medical treatments, the more sick people you have, the more money you make. There's no money in solving or preventing or curing. All the money is in chronic disease management. That's where the money is. So think about that. Think critically. A website like Mad in America is a wonderful resource. And please check out my website, Madness Radio. It's free. It's on all the different podcasting platforms. I think we have very respectful, listening-based conversations, and we're trying to get the word out that there's a different perspective. There's a different perspective out there.
One last question. What do you do if, you know, your family member, like I said, they're 18 or older, and now medically it's even more complicated because if they go to doctors and if they go to the hospital, they're not going to talk to you because the person's, you know, quote unquote, an adult. Should families go for a power of attorney? Or if you got to that point, you're too far gone? Or like, what happens if that's the situation?
Well, it's a great question. And Richard, I love your openness and your curiosity. I mean, I really, it's great what you're doing with this podcast and your interest and your willingness to have conversations, because these are not easy conversations. They're difficult questions. The situation that you describe, let's imagine that there's an 18-year-old young woman who's in the hospital who does not want to communicate with her parents. And she's blocking the parents from being part of her treatment. Now, from one perspective, that's a terrible situation because she doesn't have the support she needs. What if her father is raping her? What if there's sexual abuse in that family? What if if mom's new boyfriend gets drunk and tried to kiss her? You see, so there's a lot of complications. There's a lot of complexities. There's a lot of unknowns. I know for me that the bureaucracy of hospitals, that they don't talk with people, they don't take the time, is very destructive. And confidentiality sounds like a good thing, except when it's not. I'll give you a really quick story. When I was in a residence in San Francisco, I met this really wonderful guy and he approached me. He would sit down like, "Hey, how you doing? What's going on?" I said, "Oh, I'm having a terrible experience with my medication." He would say, "Well, just hang in there with it. Give it a try. And, you know, let's talk about it. I can tell you what my experience was." He was really, really helpful. And then he had a crisis and he went into the hospital. Suddenly, I lost my friend. So I called the hospital and I say, "Hey, I really want to talk to my friend." And they said, "He's discharged. You know, he's out." And I said, "Well, I don't have his phone number. I don't know how to reach him." He said, "Sorry, we can't give that out. Confidentiality." Now, think about that. All they had to do was take the time to call him themselves and say, "Hey, there's this guy, Will, that just called us. We want to respect your confidentiality, but he says he's your friend. Is it okay if we can connect you with him?" Like any caring person would do that. But the system is set up, bureaucracy, rules, they don't take time. The staff is often overworked and underpaid. So the situation that you're describing, like, okay, the person turned 18, now the parents are blocked. Clearly, that's a complicated situation. Everyone needs to be communicated with. They need to be checked in with. They need to take the time to say, okay, how do we actually deal with this situation? A power of attorney or a conservatorship can sometimes be really helpful, but I think that they're way overused. And it becomes, again, part of that power struggle. The young person, they have their choices are taken away from them. They're an adult. They're 18, but suddenly their choices are taken away from them. And now they're just hit with medications. They don't want to take medications. It's an either or, my way or the highway kind of situation. So what's going to happen? The person's going to be hit with heavier and heavier and heavier meds. And now suddenly you've got a 19-year-old who is safe, but they're sitting at home watching TV and they're basically a zombie because they're over-medicated. Because everyone is afraid if we reduce the meds, they're going to throw the meds away. They're going to get a little bit of clarity. They're going to throw the meds away and go hitchhiking across the country. Well, yeah, that's a real problem, but it's not either or. It's not conservatorship and forcing them on meds versus total chaos and neglect. What if someone could come in and start to make a connection with that person, build trust with that person, say, "Hey, you know, let's try and figure out how to navigate this complicated situation. I don't want you on meds either if that's not what you want to do. But remember, every time you throw the meds away, you have a manic psychotic episode. You end up across country in a hospital and your parents have to bail you out. So let's work together. Let's figure out, you want to be independent? What do you want? What are your goals? I'm on your side. I want to work with you. But you got to deal with the fact that your parents are paying the rent. Your parents are putting food on. So how do we slowly, and then I work with the parents. Hey, you know, it hasn't really worked for you to be using our overpowering force and control. Do you really want your kid to be over-medicated and have cognitive problems and even like kidney failure at age 25 and diabetes at age 25 and be obese? No, of course you don't. Well, I don't want the kid to throw the meds out the window either because that's going to create a withdrawal crisis. So let's work together." The system doesn't provide that kind of listening. The system doesn't provide that kind of careful, attentive, resource rich, because we would save money if we would actually, because that in that example, that person, that young person is on the conveyor belt to being on disability and not working for the rest of their life. That's a very expensive route. So if we put the resources in early, and that's why I encourage listeners to check out the open dialogue approach, because you put a lot of resources, as soon as there's a problem, you put a lot of resources, a lot of listening, a lot of meeting, a lot of therapy, a lot of problem solving, a lot of options, a lot of different perspectives. And then you can start to prevent the problem from getting worse. So it's a great question. And I just encourage you and your listeners to continue to learn more about all this and to explore different options.
Yeah, that was a really helpful answer. Okay, well, very good. Well, let's recap the resources for people listening. So we have your book. If you'd restate the name and say where it's available. I think you said it's available for purchase or free as a download. And then, you know, your podcast, et cetera. So go ahead, Casey.
Yeah. So my book is Outside Mental Health, Voices and Visions of Madness. And you can go to outsidementalhealth.com. You can order it a print copy through your independent local bookseller. You can also get it online, and you can also get it for free at outsidementalhealth.com. I also wrote another book. It's really a guide that you can get for free called The Harm Reduction Guide to Coming Off Psychiatric Drugs. It's not anti-drugs. It's not pro-drugs. It's meeting people where they're at. And that's actually available in many different translations. And you can get that for, you can get it online in a print version. You can also print it yourself and download a free copy yourself at my website, which is willhall.net. And I guess more than 10 years now, I've been doing a podcast, which is madnessradio.net. It's on, if you just search for Madness Radio on any of the podcasting platforms, you should be able to find it. You can also go to madnessradio.net. And of course, that's also free.
Well, excellent. Will, thanks so much for coming on the podcast and your helpful, different approach to these issues. So thank you.
Richard, you're a shining light of an example of the kind of openness, curiosity, and conversations from different perspectives that we really need more of. So thank you so much for inviting me.
Excellent.
If you like this podcast, please click the link in the description to subscribe and review us on iTunes.
You've been listening to the Finding Genius Podcast with Richard Jacobs. If you like what you hear, be sure to review and subscribe to the Finding Genius Podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And want to be smarter than everybody else? Become a premium member at FindingGeniusPodcast.com. This podcast is for information only. No advice of any kind is being given. Any action you take or don't take as a result of listening is your sole responsibility. Consult professionals when advice is needed.